Good morning, everyone. This is the second class of our Eightfold Path study. Brian kicked us off on Tuesday with a brief and concise and Brian-like presentation of Right View. So, as always, wonderful. It's available online, right?
Linked in the website and the newsletter.
In the newsletter.
I don't know if you put it on podcast yet.
Gotcha.
It's on Podbean. It's on Podbean right
And welcome, Ed, again. Today's class is on right intention. And we start off with the Buddha teaching his 7-year-old son, Rahula, about mindfulness. And why do you ask, do we start with that mindfulness? And this is a class on right intention. And the way I think about the Eightfold Path is not these eight factors. I think of it as one thing that they all support each other, they all form your understanding of each of the factors. So our focus is right intention, but this sutta speaks to the need of the Eightfold Path in its entirety. Each factor of the Eightfold Path supports the other seven factors. You cannot have right intention without right view. Whether right view is seen as an entry point to the Buddha's Dhamma, and that's basically the acknowledgement that the Four Noble Truths are true, or the culmination of the right view. And just think of right view. Is it right view all the way through? No, it's this view that you are developing and understanding along the way. So it's this overarching thing. So as you develop your practice, you start understanding what right view is. Ending in the culmination of the practice to a fully mature human being. You cannot have right view without the forerunners of right view or right intention. Right intention is the driver and the force behind your actions. Right intention in this practice provides the direction to skillful outcomes in your thoughts, words, and deeds. And during this sutta that the Buddha's instructing Rahula, he's doing that with a 7-year-old. So he's not fully ordained at this point, but he's teaching him how to reflect on his words, thoughts, and deeds. The mindfulness that the Buddha refers to cannot be experienced without the support of the other seven factors. The eight factors together should always be pointing to the culmination of the insight to the three marks of existence. These are John's words. The Buddha teaches his son to reflect on each action of the body, of speech, and the thought before acting, while acting, and after acting. This sutta teaches us the connection to our intentions and our every action. Our mindfulness is ever more refined as our jhana meditation deepens. So again, these are all connected. All these factors point toward right view. So when you are looking at the virtuous factors, which Matt will kick off on Tuesday, you have to have a jhana practice to develop the refined mindfulness, to see what your actions are, see what your words are. You can't reflect properly without mindfulness. These are the Buddha's words. And what bhikkhus is right intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will, intention of harmlessness. This is called right intention. Some more of John's words. Right intention is the intention to abandon all views of impermanent self so that the right view may be developed completely to its culmination. And the three types of right intention: the intention of renunciation, eliminate attachment to desires, craving for wrong views, sense desires. These craving for and clinging to these five aggregates are what normally motivates our actions, causing stress and suffering. The feelings that these cravings and aversions generate cannot be maintained because of the nature of their impermanence. The intention of goodwill. And then finally, the intention of harmlessness, not to cause pain to yourself or others through your thoughts, words, or deeds. And again, right intention is the key driver of action along this Eightfold Path. It provides a scope and direction for our practice. Right intention precedes and is required for the practice of right effort. If you do not understand the scope of right intention, then you cannot have right effort. You can have good effort, you can have good intentions, you can have good speech, and it might come out as to the world, she has good intentions. But if it's not bundled with this package of the Eightfold Path, it's not gonna ultimately let you have insight to the three marks, which means you will at some point suffer because this thing you want way cannot be maintained. So therefore they're suffering. These are John's words. Again, without right intention, the virtuous and concentration factors of the path cannot be properly developed. So it's a scope, it's a focus. It calls to action. This is what this practice is. I went into this whole thing about right effort. I'm going to leave that to Kevin because, again, it's points toward, think of it this way. If you donate something, if you give to charity and your intention is selfish one, I want to be seen as a giver, a good person. That's not virtuous. But if it's bundled in this Dhamma practice that we're developing, then it may never be seen by anyone. But yet, your intent is wholesome and skillful. When our intentions are guided and formed by right view, then our actions will be reflected in right speech, right action, right livelihood. We will exercise skillful, wise restraint. And this is the Rahulavada Sutta, Instructions of Rahula. The Buddha was sitting with his son Rahula, who was 7 at the time. The Buddha asked Rahula if he saw the few drops of water left in the ladle the Buddha was holding. Rahula replied that he did. The Buddha tells Rahula that this is how little understanding one has who tells deliberate lies. The Buddha then tosses away the few drops of water and tells Rahula, a person who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies has tossed away their mindfulness. The Buddha then turns the ladle upside down and tells Rahula, a person who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies has turned their mindfulness upside down. The Buddha then shows Rahula the empty ladle and says, whoever feels no shame in telling a deliberate lie is as empty and as hollow as this ladle. Anyone who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies is capable of any wrongdoing. Train yourself, Rahula. I will not tell a deliberate lie for any reason, even jokingly. Then the Buddha asks Rahula if he knows what a mirror is for, and Rahula replies, for a reflection, sir. So, if you think about the seven factors, skillful, wise investigation. Now, Rahul is 7 years old, so he's just asking him to reflect. But what we do is reflect in wise investigation. It allows us to, within this practice, look to our words. and thoughts and deeds, and see if we are truly in the Eightfold Path. It's not a judgment, it's not harsh. And that's what I always think of gentleness to yourself. This practice has allowed me to be gentle with myself while I reflect and investigate how my practice is doing. Connecting with our intentions. So the Buddha continues, in the same way, your thoughts, words, and deeds must be done with constant reflection. Reflect in this manner, Rahula. Is this thought, word, or deed skillful? Will it lead to harm for myself or others? Or will it lead to release? Will this thought, word, or deed bring more suffering for myself or others? Or will it have peaceful results? If upon reflection of your thoughts, words, and deeds, you will have peaceful results, then this is fit for you and fit for the person developing understanding. Rahula, all those who purify their minds through continual reflection, mindfulness, will do so in just this way. Rahula, you should train yourself in just this way through continual mindfulness of your thoughts, words, and deeds. End of sutta. These are more of John's words. Of course, it takes great wisdom developed through the Eightfold Path to completely understand all the effects of our thoughts, words, and deeds through mindfulness of thoughts, words, and deeds, supported by right view and right intention, and deepens as our concentration develops through right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So this is a package deal. This is not a path that you're bumping into these factors along the way. This is a package deal that you are carrying with you moment by moment throughout the day. You cannot have right effort if you do not have the intentions. It's the scope of the practice. Good speech, not formed by right view and right intention, is simply going to cause stress because it's not structured in a way where you're developing understanding of the three marks. So we'll go to the poem here. Again, this is a poem. John always states it as two suttas, but it truly is just a poem. This poem is from the Theragatha. It's a 264 poems of elder monks. And this is Rahula's. The Buddha's Son Unbound. And this is after the Buddha's son, many years later, has awakened. So he's describing what his experience has been. Accomplished in the world and the Dhamma, I'm Rahula the fortunate. I'm the son of the Buddha. I see the Dhamma and my influence ended. Free of ignorance, no further becoming. I'm worthy of offerings. I know the three marks clearly seeing the deathlessness. Those blinded by the veil of craving, clinging to Mara, they are like fish in a net. Abandoning sensual distractions, rooted in ignorance, the flames of craving behind me, I am cool and unbounded. End of the poem. So we'll go around the room. Again, this was this short and sweet. I think I can track all you folks this way. I'm going to turn you around. We'll start with Kevin. Good morning.
Morning, David. Thanks for the teaching. It is just really short and sweet and so direct. And thank you for your teaching. It brings us back to the basis of all this again, too. So thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's go to Anthony. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning. This brings up a question for me that I would put out to you, David, in the class. When I read this, there was a constant emphasis on not telling deliberate lies. And as I thought about that, I realized that there's a place where lying and kindness intersect. And so I feel it particularly in myself if someone were to ask me about their looks or their body or maybe even clothing they're wearing, I feel that if I don't like it or I think that person isn't attractive or they don't have a good body, that I want to lie, because in that sense, it's kind, it's skillful, and it will bring suffering to you or that and that person. And I wonder, how do we deal with those kinds of really touchy subjects? Particularly when somebody throws it out, like, don't I look really good? You know, what do you say to that? And so it caused a little angst for me when I read it.
Well, I moonwalk out the room. But if I was to use the approach of the Dhamma, right speech is governed by noble silence, timeliness. Is it beneficial for the group to hear the truth? The Buddha would always lean toward that, but he understood when it was timed not to speak. And it is tricky because us as householders are going to be asked, how's my hair look? And is it to say that it looks wonderful, or I really prefer you to have short hair? Well, you know, again, is my words beneficial? Is that moment in time being skillful? And I would say that that's not a skillful way to be honest. And I think in the case of Ahula, he's a 7-year-old, and I think we've talked about this. I'm guessing he got caught lying.
Yeah, he definitely.
He got caught lying, yeah. And in a way.
Yeah, somebody. Never. Sorry.
Sorry. Hold on. Oh, Tracy. And he got caught, and you know, he wasn't ordained yet. I think Sariputta brought him into the Sangha at a later date. But you know, he was a little boy who got caught lying. And this is a gentle way to say, be mindful of your thoughts, words, and deeds. And
he was caught lying, I think, to his dad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think silence could be uncomfortable too, but what I've found is useful for me in those situations is to find other things to compliment.
Yeah, see? Those shoes are pretty. Again, it,
oh,
you know,
puppy.
Yeah, it's a distraction. But again, it's, we are householders in the world. And, you know, I would always err on the side of, if there's nothing good to say, then there's noble silence. And in the, how that looks in the real world is that you're gentle.
I think when you, what the take home is from the teaching is, reflect on how your mind is. Mm. Reflect on how your mind is after. Mm. What you, what you learn from doing that is, how does your mind look and feel when you lie? And what is the craving and clinging that you experience when you lie, regardless of what your intention was around the lying? And then also when you pause and remain silent, you know, what comes up then? What is your experience around that? How does your mind feel and look? You know, and then we're moving away from a conditioned response, and we're changing our minds when we don't do the same thing we always do. When, you know, our loved one asks us if they look good today, you do something different in that moment, you start to change.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe in some sense you retain a bit of integrity through your honesty, because people, I think, sort of can see through that if you're lying and you don't really mean it.
Thanks, Anthony.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Yeah. So I just to add to what was just said. So like for me, in a situation like that, like my first guiding principle is like to do no harm. Right. So I think there's always a way to be nice and have a good outcome. Like there's no wrong way to do the right thing. And I don't think, you know, in a situation like you just described, you know, being brutally honest would probably do harm to that person and to yourself. So I think there's always an opportunity to find something nice to say. That would be sort of my reaction to that situation. But in terms of the Sutta, I loved when there's metaphors, because it's easier for me to understand. And you know, the droplets of water in the ladle, and I think it's a really great story, and it's very helpful for me. So again, nice meeting you all. It's the first time I've joined this call. I've been doing a lot of the readings from John, and have a great day, everyone.
Thank you. We're here Tuesdays at 7:15 and Saturdays at 8:30. So please join us
right,
again.
Right on. Yeah, I certainly will. Yeah, I live in Belmar, New Jersey. So otherwise I would pop in, but thanks.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, everyone. I realized that I am in a central time zone, so I missed the whole class. So sorry about that. Nice to be here and see everybody's face.
Thank you for joining, no matter how long. Go around the room. Let's go to my friend Julia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the teaching, David. I liked in the poem to Ed's point about the metaphors, the fish in the net, that really helps me conceptualize conditioned thinking. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to find that useful. So thank you.
Let's go to Raquel. How many of them are right here?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, David, for the teaching. To me today, what I thought was interesting is to learn that the Buddha was teaching his son, 7 years old. And so I had this conversation with Matthew before, like, you know, we should start teaching kids at early age. I would be in a lot better state of mind today if I was learning this earlier. And I know some other, I know it's becoming more and more popular now to start teaching kids at very early age, meditation and mindfulness. So I thought that for that aspect was, to me, it was very interesting to learn that Buddha was teaching 7 years old. So, thank you.
And just remember, the Buddha meditated himself at a very early age to just at that point just calm himself. And he essentially had his technique and method that he returned to. So you can see how the Buddha taught his son. It wasn't full of, you know, things beyond mindfulness and reflection. So, good morning, Mark.
Good morning all. David, thank you for the teaching. I will take the global service today.
Thank you. Hi, Jen.
Hi. So right intention is holding in mind the intention to relinquish clinging and craving in every thought, word, and deed. No small feat. And when we hold that in mind, then we're more likely to recognize when we crave and cling, and when we are craving and clinging, and how we can begin to abandon that. And yeah.
And isn't it like what you start seeing is like this thing I do twice a day, and what I come to class twice a week? It's building that concentration so I can be mindful. And therefore, I have that moment of reflection that becomes, whether it's something I've put down or it's just wise restraint. And to Raquel's point, I think you can teach that stuff to children without overwhelming them with, you know, all this that comes along with it. So when it, you know, Rahul in the poem is describing what he's been instructed on and experienced himself. So, you know, like you said, I wish this existed.
You can see the eye making.
Yeah.
Yeah, instead of
which punishing, is the point. Yeah.
I'm sorry, when you do something wrong, instead of being punished, just be teaching. Yeah. Taught, you know, it would be nice that you had learned this the other way.
Mm-hmm. Laying the guilt and moralism on your kids. Self-restraint.
Yeah, it's almost it can reinforce bad behavior.
Right, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Plant that rebellious seed in you.
And I know how it is going to Catholic school, with everything about punishment. What have you done wrong? The right or wrong intentions was not emphasized, of course.
Thank you.
He was teaching to a lot. He's not just telling them, don't do this. He's just saying, when you do this, this is what happens. So, you know, it's your choice. Mm-hmm. You can reflect on this. You can not tell lies and see what happens. Yeah, there wasn't any finger wagging.
No, and to Ed's point, you know, how do you feel when you are doing it? You'll feel that tension. You'll feel that you're experiencing eye making. Dukkha. Eye making. So it is truly all connected. And, you know, if you think about, like, at that point of contact, if you are instructed, then that feeling will be understood as simply a feeling. Therefore, the possibility of not craving the way you were predisposed before that is possible, and that's our practice. Mm-hmm. Bridget?
I think that's you know, finally, as usual, the sutta is kind of helping me address something that I didn't realize I was going through. I realize I'm going through it, but I didn't realize maybe exactly what was happening. It's offering me some clarity about lying on a couple of different levels. So, you know, right now life is just throwing situations at me minute by minute, and am, especially when it comes to my children. My intention is always pure, right? Like in its form, you know what I mean? Like protect life, but I can lie to myself in a moment about, am I really saying that to my child because I want them to know that, to learn that, to do that? Or am I telling myself this is for their benefit, but it's really not, you know? So first there's deciding about if I'm lying to myself about my intention in that moment. It may all be driven by like a love for the child, but love is not the same thing as right view, or, you know, that's a feeling. Then there's like, you know, kind of taking the do I look nice to a farther level when children ask you some of those big questions. Sometimes, you know, the brutal honesty is not always the right answer, but then having the clarity of mind to come up with a skillful response, even if the response is, this isn't something we can discuss right now, or maybe changing to how the child's feeling that made them ask the question or something, to have the clarity of mind to do that. You know, I've been able to do it in social situations, like a handful of times. I kind of get the knack of saying, I don't want to lie to this person, but what's a skillful thing I can say? And that takes so much concentration, where the feelings are a lot less powerful. But with my kids, my brain is just like, it's a difficult thing to do. So yeah, I mean, all I'm really taking away is, you know, keep practicing being able to maybe notice it, you know, on a deeper level, to notice the layers of lie, you know, within myself, and then an outward facing lie.
I mean, the layers of lying that we all experience in our day to day. Do you smile to your boss because he was so funny, or are you so right? Or just smiling because it gets you past that moment? Is that any worse than what you do with your children? Because maybe it's not the time, and it plants a seed in your mind because you're mindful of that moment that I need to follow back around with this when it's more appropriate. And again, it's not, this is not a perfect world that we're living in as far as householders out there with the need to navigate each moment. And it's not supposed to be perfect. You're supposed to be aware when something arises and is passing away. And to, again, to Ed's point, you know, do no harm. Have goodwill. So, thank you. Zach.
I think you just touched on what I've been thinking about in terms of this concept of lying. Why do we tell white lies? Why do we tell any kind of lie? It's an aversion to what's occurring. Trying to get, as you just said, ourselves out of a situation that we feel uncomfortable about. Answering this question, actually, from a householder perspective, I think is a difficult one. I think the practice, though, would suggest that if you feel the need to tell a white lie, then you are not in right view, because you're being ignorant to the first truth, which is their suffering. And furthermore, I think you're not in right view because you're stuck within your conditioned view. But I don't have an answer as a lay person.
It may be the answer. I was thinking about this when, you know, we go back to the how's my hair look question and the inevitable landmines that you're tiptoeing around. And maybe, and I'm not this person yet, learning how to have honest conversations like a couple? How do you have that conversation? The difficult conversations about money or the activity someone's doing, or, you know, how's my dress look?
Mm.
Maybe it's
now it depends on the existing relationship that you have and the level of mindfulness on both ends.
Yeah.
And that's where I constantly change. Like the best answer.
Maybe that's the workshop. Maybe that's the workshop of how do I have that conversation in a way where it's beneficial for everyone and it doesn't cause harm to me or myself. And is it just better just to go, hair looks pretty, move on to the next one? You know, maybe it's better for the first noble truth that I'm not going to contribute unnecessarily, and I'm not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for me just to, you know, I've ignored it. Look how that goes. You know, so it maybe that's the reflection, the reflection that the Buddha is asking us to do.
Right. I also think what Ron was getting at is I think a lot of it has to do with wise association,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah.
As we've all talked about, like our relationships change when we move into this practice and we find ourselves in mm-hmm. different situations where we're not really being asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all going to come across those questions, whether it's somebody, is this a good idea? And you're not going to tell them that they're an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a good question.
Yeah. And I'll just use like the example of when we have teachers' meetings, and we've had pretty serious topics come up, and we are absolutely honest and gentle, and I don't think we've ever had a moment where we're like so angry or frustrated, because we resolve it within the Dhamma. And it that's one of the, you know, I've seen like difficult conversations take place, and it's possible to have honest conversation.
Yeah, I think we're kind of getting what we're talking about now is right speech.
Mm-hmm.
And right speech is really the one sutta that I'm thinking of, and I can't remember the name of it, where the Buddha gets into just right speech and explains lots of different possible scenarios of,
yep.
What do you know? I can't remember what the sutta is.
No, I know the one.
He gets very granular about what
the prince.
If this is the right, mm-hmm. if this is what's happening, then you do this, and mm-hmm. if this is what's happening, then you do this, and so, you know, it's not like there's just a one kind of answer thing. It's really like what Bridget was getting at, which is having that clarity of mind to say the skillful thing in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, okay, generally a lie is not the best, is just generally not the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you're the grown-up.
Yeah.
So you're in the situation, you get to decide what you're going to do. And when you do, make sure you observe your mind in the process
mm-hmm.
of whatever choice you make. And then that'll help you figure out where to go.
And to go back to what... Go ahead. That's what
first.
I was asking. What's right intention?
Yeah.
Right
so
intention.
Like, I know as a mother, any decision I've ever made, of course for me, I always go back to being a mother, because for me, that's where it seems to count the most and I pay the most attention to it. But if I made the decision and I know that I reflected that with a calm mind, my intention was good, even if it turns out poorly later, I might regret the dukkha, you know, I might not like that, okay, that didn't turn out great,
mm-hmm.
but I don't feel the same stress mm-hmm. and additional suffering, because I know that I made that intention with nothing but like pure, good, right intention. It's mm-hmm. when you said something, you made a lie, oh, that person's just saying, or, oh, they were just, mm-hmm. oh, well, don't worry about that. It's just, you know, and then you see it play out and you're like, okay, I've created a whole other problem here. And then you think back on your attention. It's like, oh yeah, I was trying to avoid more suffering, or I was too exhausted to deal with
yeah.
it fully.
That's
or
usually mine.
Right? Like
that's
just
4 p.m.
tap next,
like, not
right?
Done yet.
And then you can, especially, you know, with children, you have such a close and important relationship with them. You can do a lot of harm.
Mm-hmm.
That
all those little lies are stacking up, and is that that's forming this child. And at some point those children aren't children anymore, and they will reflect back
mm-hmm.
and see how those conversations went.
And it makes who they are, who they
yeah,
turn into.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's like, it's so stinking important.
Yeah.
So yeah, her intention.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. This has been really good for me, especially listening to everyone, because right intention and telling a lie is something that I've been struggling with for the last week over something that I'm planning. And just sitting here today, I have gone over in my mind, what is my intention? I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you're bringing two sets of disparate people together, and you're the
desperate or disparate?
Disparate. Did I say desperate?
No,
disparate.
I just wanted
disparate.
To say.
And you're the one in the middle. And you really don't want to be in that situation. And so I want to tell a little white lie to one side of that equation so that I can deal with these two disparate sets of people separately, not together. And I have gone over in my mind, what's my intention? Why don't I want to be in this? You know, it's really, but every time I come back to being in that situation, I cannot, I just can't go there. And it may be that I'm thinking of this situation is going to be much worse than it really is, because now I'm projecting myself into the future. So that's where I am. And this really helped, and I still have more to do in trying to make this decision. But
the good news is you're
yeah.
aware of it.
I'm aware of it.
And
yeah.
you're going at it with
the stress that I feel being in the situation, imagining myself in the situation totally is much worse than any
yeah.
stress I think I would feel if I told a lie.
Yeah,
I think sometimes anticipation of a stressful situation is
worse
than that.
Yes,
being an
actual absolutely.
Situation.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But I think, I mean, if you have to bring those together, a group of people that are different opinions or points of view, one way that I would think about it is, you know, it's in a forceful discussion where the truth comes out.
Well, it's not so much that I would anticipate a difficult discussion. It's more that I don't want to I don't want to have to figure out how to engage with both at the same time. It's like, this side needs taken care of, and this side I could just blend in and be okay with, but then I have to go back and take care of this side. It's just being, I don't know, It's and it's wanting to control, and mm-hmm. I'm totally down the rabbit hole. At least I know it, and
in the bell jar.
In the bell jar. Yeah. And when I really step back, it's probably all going to resolve itself. Because it's a couple months away, and who knows what will happen. I just am in the bell jar. I'm admitting it right in front. But anyway, this was good because it will help me step back and think about what my intention is. And think about how to address the situation as honestly and as I can for myself.
So first you'll be honest with yourself.
For myself.
About your intention.
Right.
And that may lead to
and that may lead, to yes.
With others.
It probably will, as a matter of fact.
I wish you well.
Thank you.
I mean, you go in with the practice that is allowing you to have some clarity because you have a level of mindfulness that you've developed. And that doesn't exclude you from the inevitable dukkha that may occur. But intention is, right intention is a guiding thing.
It certainly
is. It guides your actions. So is it a perfect situation? No. Mm-hmm. No. So if that helps as far as just being able to go into a situation with some clarity and some right intention, then therefore this is what the practice is for. That you're aware that it's arising and you know it's going to pass away.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I love this song.
Thank you for making that.
Only took a couple of hours. You see an issue and you try to come up with a solution. It's just my mind at work. That's all. This little sutta for Rahula is interesting because he addresses right intention and I guess right view at the same time. And the answer or the instruction that he gives Rahula is reflect. And for us as householders, this is where the importance of both right view and right intent comes in almost daily to reflect on what is my intent? Is my view right? Do I really understand what I'm doing here? Do I have a good enough understanding of the Four Noble Truths to guide my actions? And this reflection really should be a daily thing. Mm-hmm. When you start out in the practice, it's like, oh, there's such things as right view. Wow. And oh, this is how this thing is supposed to work. And then the thought is, what am I going to do with that? How does this fit in my life? And those conversations with yourself just are ongoing, and they change. Mm-hmm. And most of the time they get easier. But it's funny that he takes the example of lying as what he wants to teach Rahula on this. Because it is, as we've seen from the conversation here, that that's a nice sneaky little guy.
Yeah.
Everybody runs into it pretty pretty often. And I like what Zach said, that it gets you right into starting to reflect on right association.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're constantly in a situation where you have to, where you get this stress of, can I say this? Can I not say this? You know, do I want to say this? And at that point, your associations are not optimal. What you can do about it is a different story. But again, it's good to reflect on that. Oh, yeah, this is about association. Apart from being about right speech, but it's also about association. That's how deep that goes.
I mean, mine is essentially a selfishness. It's a reflection of I'm making. You want something to be different than what is happening. And if you're trying to negotiate this little moment with your child, you have to make, like Jen said, you're an adult. You have to manage that, knowing that you're in this practice. And upon reflection, upon investigation, based on these 8 right factors, how's that tumbling down to how you feel? And if you're feeling stressful, feeling not good, then that reflection should be pointing you towards something. It really is just it's a litmus test of each moment. It's karma. Look in that mirror and see how that's going. And sometimes you don't have a choice. You can't have that conversation with this kid at this moment, or you can't figure out this thing to put together. And you know, looking out into the future is causing you stress. And maybe that's clouding the way to resolve it. And we do that every day at work. If we're clear, we are absolutely locked in. But if we're thinking about the past and the ramifications of the past or future and trying to figure that out, what do you do in this moment? You're not focused. This practice is all about understanding the 3 marks of existence. That's all it's for. And if we can always reflect back to these core things, I think it becomes easier. So.
Can you elaborate on the right association?
Pardon?
Association. Right association.
Association.
You guys taking off?
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Zach.
Thank you, folks.
Hi, guys. Thank you.
She asked about right association.
Yeah, when you talk about right association, you're looking at the effects that who you associate with has on you, on your behavior. And it involves a lot of your life once you start looking at right association, because the inevitable question that comes up is, am I going to continue in this association or not? Or how did I get into this? You know, what's in me that got me into this situation? And it may just be family, but it could also be a work situation. And more invasively almost is, okay, the people that I hang out with voluntarily, who are they, and what is the effect of this association on my practice? That's in the end is, you know, looking at right association is, what does this do for my practice? And there are situations where you say, well, I can step back a little bit because this relationship is pushing me a certain way on my path, and it's not the right way. Or, hey, this is actually, you know, I can talk with these people. It's not a stressful situation. I can talk about the things that matter in my life, and I don't have to tell any lies. Mm.
It's pretending is lying.
Right.
So sometimes as an association, I've asked myself, what am I getting out of this? Mm-hmm. Why do I keep going back? I noticed maybe like 10 years ago, I had a couple of friends. Every time I went, I was like, I am definitely going to have a glass of wine to hang with this person. And that was like my first red flag, even before the path. Was like, oh, if I have to have a glass of wine or two mm-hmm. to hang out with this person, for them to be fun or for me to tolerate them, why am I hanging out with them? And then as the path, you know, came into practice, came into my life, I took it a little deeper to why am I spending time with this person? If I'm putting on a fake mask or mm-hmm. pretending, you know, right. essentially lying, why am I going back? What is my intention? What am I? And I think there's an element not only of dishonesty, but you're taking something. And it's something that's harmful, you know, and you take it because you cling to it, but then you're hurting yeah. yourself with it, and you're hurting the other person.
But in some situations, you cannot avoid, right? Like you right. have family members. Or
sure. Yes, you have to avoid them. If you want to keep practicing, you have to absolutely avoid them. Figure it out.
That's in your life. If that's work and family, you know, your siblings and
well, you go into the situation with a bit more awareness and with the intent of not allowing the stress to overcome you.
You're going in with right intention.
Yeah, going with
Jennifer.
Jennifer. Yeah, so that's what I was going to say is that you want to cultivate the ability to observe your mind and your body throughout your day. And then when things come up, when an association occurs, you are in the headspace where you can observe how, you know, what tends to come up around that. And in so doing, you're being more mindful about how you set your life up.
Yeah.
So the beginning of that sutta that where the Buddha discusses wise associations, he says, make sure that you engage in with other individuals who are practicing the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. So that's like, make sure that you have, right, you have a Sangha. And so in so doing, you are aware of what your fourth foundation of mindfulness. So what does your mind look like when you are engaged in the Sangha? Mm-hmm. And then you take that out into other kinds of associations, and you're able to start to recognize what comes up for you in certain interactions. Mm-hmm. And then you can start to see, okay, what am I contributing? How am I contributing to this situation being stressful? Mm-hmm. And what can I do differently?
Sometimes it's this wise restraint.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
this gross restraint. But what you were describing was, this association is not healthy and I'm lying mm-hmm. to myself. So do you throw the association overboard, or you try to change the association? Mm-hmm. Because this practice is, I can only change what I see my mind doing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm changing this association. So I've never been of the belief that I can be with anyone because I think differently now. So my association with this person is different. They don't like it. They may throw me overboard. It's fair.
Right.
But I don't need to shut people off because I can't handle that they're drinking right. in front of me.
Right.
But
right.
I am at peace with sitting in front of somebody because exactly. I know that I am being mindful. So as you develop your practice, you're bringing different tools and skills to this association. Doesn't mean that it's any easier when they're coming at you with their old behaviors and, you know, the things that would normally cause suffering. Mm-hmm. Again, it's practices to be developed.
But you, yeah, that's so good, David. Okay. That's the only thing you have control over. You only have control over your contribution and your mind.
Yep.
So if it's so bad that it overwhelms you.
Or if you change your behavior, but you no longer have anything in common with mm-hmm. the person.
Right, exactly.
Some things fall away.
Yeah. You know, like, so, but if you can be with them mindfully, then you're not hurting them and they're not hurting you, as far as I'm concerned. Even if it doesn't feel pleasant, or I don't know. It's just that if you're there mindfully, you can see what they're contributing and you can see how to respond.
Yeah, that's wise association.
That's why, mm-hmm. yeah.
It doesn't mean that the other person is necessarily a practitioner.
That's right.
But there's not that doubling up of negative energy that will cause this moment to be absolutely what you're worried about.
Right.
Guess what? You're going in with a different dynamic and that exactly. will be right there. It will be more likely inclined to be peaceful.
Yes, exactly.
Again, it's something that has to be seen as it arises. If it's coming at you too fast, it's by you and it's painful and it's suffering. But if it's something that you can mindfully see and know that it's going to arise and pass away, that association will be different than what it was before the practice.
Yeah, I think in a way the practices can help you to deal with the life situation.
Yeah, because it happens all out here. This is the easiest place in the world to have wise associations mm-hmm. because we all are kind and peaceful, mm-hmm. and it's the room that itself demands this behavior, and it becomes easy. Mm-hmm. Go into the bus, go into the boardroom, go into the Thanksgiving classroom, children. It allows you because all I can handle and be responsible for is myself. If you change someone along the way, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anything else online?
No, thank you.
All right, we will finish with Metta. Karani and Metta Sutta, as always. Again, Ed, thank you so much for joining. Please join again. And this is what is done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. They are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. They remain unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. They are peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. They do not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. They are always mindful that all beings be at ease, whatever living beings they may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. They are always mindful not to deceive another or despise any being in any state. They abandon anger and ill will with ease, never wishing harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, the wise disciple cherishes all living beings. They radiate kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, they maintain refined mindfulness. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, having completed the path, does not give another birth to another moment rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Thank you, everyone. Have a good weekend.